On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with our friend Aaron Pendergrass about the mediatorial office of Christ. We cover topics like, what is it? What is the function of these offices? What ways has contemporary Christianity narrowed the mediatorial office? Is it something that's temporary? Is it something that's eternal? How did Calvin think about this, and how did that influence successive thinkers on this topic? As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, you can always hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or you can email us at contact@thelondonlyceum.com. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Now, for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum, a place for friendly discussion and debate that is designed to generate deep and clear thinking. I am one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak.
And I'm your other host, Brandon Askew.
And today, I'm really looking forward to introducing you to one of my new friends, Aaron Pendergrass. And we're going to be talking about the enduring mediatorial office of Christ. So it's kind of a timely topic, I think, because I just saw a blog post yesterday come out on Calvin's thoughts on his on Christ's role as mediator, and making some comments about it potentially ending. So I don't remember exactly how me and Aaron got connected. I think it was actually through the podcast. We direct messaged somehow, and we were just chatting and found out he did, I think, an MA thesis on this topic. He sent it over to me under James Arcati, who we've had on the show, who's brilliant, awesome, cool guy. And maybe we'll have him on in the future again to talk about something else. We had him on back when we were rookies at podcasting. So I think the sound quality wasn't there for some reason. So we've since figured all that kind of stuff out. Anyway, we were talking. He sent me this thesis, and it was fascinating. So I thought this would be a great topic to talk about. Really fits well with the show. So I'm looking forward to doing that. Plus, I imagine most people don't know who Aaron is, and I think that's part of the fun of the podcast, is introducing our listeners to all sorts of people. We like to introduce, you know, our Baptist and confessional friends to analytic theology guys, and vice versa. I like to introduce our analytic theology friends to our Baptist and confessional friends. And then I also like to have people who are well-known and people who no one knows. So Aaron, I hope I didn't offend you by saying no one knows who you are, but maybe you give us a little bit of background on who you are for those who may not be familiar with you. And then what made you become interested in this topic of Christ as mediator?
Yeah. So my name is Aaron Pendergrass. I grew up in Jackson, Tennessee, near the Memphis side of the state. Went to Bryan College and got a Bachelor's of Science in Christian Ministry with a pastoral focus and a minor in Biblical Studies. And that's where I really whet my appetite for a love for theology before I came to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and got a Master of Arts in Systematic Theology. I am currently an associate pastor at Bethel Baptist Church in Greeley, Colorado. Part of my job is not only to assist the senior pastor in the day in and day out, but also to bring some, cast some vision for the youth ministry as well. So I got a leg in the associate role and a leg in the youth ministry role, and I theologize on the side. While I was at TEDS, I wrote a thesis under my advisors, Dr. James Arcati and Dr. Manich, on the enduring mediatorial office of Christ and Calvin and the Reformed tradition. I became interested in this topic after coming across Todd Billings' book, Union with Christ, and realized that this was a discussion in Calvin studies, particularly when you look at Book 2, Section 5, Chapter 15 of the Institutes. The question becomes, is Christ's mediatorial office only for a time, and will that end? Because God will reign over us immediately rather than mediately? Or is this something that's enduring and that's eternal? And so first I came across some of these contentious like debates in Calvin studies. And first I thought it was a temporary office, but the more I studied and looked at every single instance of the word mediator in Calvin's commentaries and the Institutes, my mind had changed as to what Calvin was really saying.
Well, Aaron, thanks again for giving us some time today. Why don't we just begin with what do we mean when we say the mediatorial office of Christ? What are we talking about when we say Christ is the mediator?
Yeah, so I think the First London Baptist Confession of Faith puts it really well. I think it's chapter 13 or section 13 on the first confession. This office to be the mediator, that is to be prophet, priest, and king of the Church of God, is so proper to Christ that neither in whole nor in any part can it be transferred from him to any other. And it's a threefold office. This number and order of offices is necessary, for in respect of our ignorance, we stand in need of Christ's prophetical office. In respect of our great alienation from God, we need his priestly office to reconcile us. And in respect of our averseness and utter inability to return to God, we need his kingly office to convince, subdue, draw, uphold, and preserve us to his heavenly kingdom. What you'll see in some literature is you read about the mediatorial office of Christ. This is also known as the munus triplex. That's the Latin phrase for the threefold office, where Christ reigns and rules and operates as a prophet, priest, and king on our behalf.
Good stuff. So you mentioned these, I guess, I don't know if they're titles or functions or what's the proper term for them, the prophet, priest, and king that you mentioned. What functions do those actually do? And are there any other, I guess, offices that are subsumed under the mediatory role of Christ?
Yeah, so it's a debate within the conversation whether the munus triplex is a threefold office or if they're actually three separate offices. It looks like in the Baptist confessions, they've come to eventually believe that that office was a threefold office. And in my thesis, I argue for at least five different functions within that mediatorial office, but the prophet, priest, king, offices are all subsets of those functions. So you can find all of those functions under the prophetic and the priestly and the kingly offices.
So some of those, I guess, functions would be shared between the offices. So like prophet and priest could do the same function or am I misunderstanding?
Yeah. So I think you could say that, the intercessory function of Christ, for example, is something that's under his priesthood.
Yeah.
And we could say that the incarnation is something that's under his priesthood. And we could say that the prophetic function, like we see in chapter 8 of the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith, I think it's actually in section 6 of chapter 8. Although the price of redemption was not actually paid by Christ till after his incarnation, yet the virtue, efficacy, and benefit thereof were communicated to the elect in all ages, successively from the beginning of the world, in and by those promises, types, and sacrifices where he was revealed and signified to be the seed. So we see that although Christ did not become a priest yet until the incarnation, we see the London Baptist Confession of Faith, 1689, saying that through Christ's prophetic ministry, he was communicating himself as a priest that was to come, even though he had not yet became a priest.
So obviously the categories of prophet, priest, and king are biblical categories. You know, those are words that we see used in scripture. But as far as being used in this way and together, as far as the threefold office, do you know how that developed throughout the Christian tradition until we get to the Reformation? I guess my question is, was it spoken of that way throughout the history of the church, or does that language of prophet, priest, and king being, I guess, a summary of the mediatorial office, is that a strictly reformational wording?
Yeah, so we do see in the writings of Augustine and Aquinas this aspect of Christ's mediatorial office. particularly being a prophet and being a king. But we don't see anybody really putting all three of these offices together until the Reformation, particularly when we get to John Calvin. He's the one that popularizes this motif of prophet, priest, and king, and it catches fire and continues to carry on within the theological writings in the Reformation and post-Reformation era after Calvin's influence. But what I've seen from the writings of Augustine and Aquinas that have hinted at it, I don't see this munus triplex idea happening until the Reformation period.
Okay, well, since you mentioned Calvin, I guess we can let's talk about him for a minute. So what is his specific contribution and in this discussion? You know, I guess he's drawing a little bit on Augustine and Aquinas, since they had used two of the three together. But what's his unique contribution?
Yeah, and can you speak to the question that I saw, I guess, come across in this blog today or yesterday about Calvin saying that Christ, I guess, stops being mediator? And you shot me over another article by Stephen Wedgeworth that basically says the same thing. And I looked it up in his Institutes in Book 2, Chapter 14, Section 3. And he does say, we shall, I guess, Christ having then discharged the office of mediator. So tell us what Calvin's thinking. And especially, I'm curious about what he means by discharging the office.
Yeah. So we see that Calvin's mediatorial theology really starts to become formed under a time of theological necessity. There was this one heterodox theologian by the name of Francesco Stancaro that had come across Calvin and had eventually become a professor in a few of the neighboring countries that Calvin was in. And he looked at the 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5, passage that says there is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. So he started to argue that the mediatorial office was only something unique to Jesus's humanity, and that only the man part of Jesus was a mediator. Osiander, which was a Lutheran theologian and friends with Philip Melanchthon, had started debating against Francesco Stancaro and started arguing that Christ was a mediator according to the divine nature. Calvin saw a lot of this going on and felt like he needed to intervene. And so he writes against Francesco Stancaro in a document pertaining to the true partaking in the flesh and blood of Christ in the Lord's Supper, where he argues for a real presence view of the Lord's Supper rather than a corporeal like eating view. But he talks about the necessity of Jesus having to be a mediator according to the divine and the human nature. And he says to Francesco Stancaro, you're wrong that Jesus became a mediator, because Jesus was a mediator even in the Old Testament, and he's a mediator over the angels. So Calvin starts to formulate this idea of Christ being a cosmic mediator and makes a distinction between creator and creature, and says that Christ is not a creature, and Christ wouldn't be a properly fit mediator unless he was the creator also. And in my thesis, I start to argue that Calvin had five different functions in mind for the office of the mediator. It's this idea of being a cosmic mediator. And Calvin points to Colossians 1, for by Christ all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers and authorities. And he points to Hebrews 1. And we see it throughout the rest of his writings, where he thinks that the angel of the Lord is a Christophany, or is Jesus in the Old Testament. That's highly contested. But Calvin believes that that Christ essentially mediated the law because of that Galatians 4 passage, where the law was given through the hand of an intermediary or a mediator, and says that Christ, as the angel of the Lord, is mediating the law to people and communicating the those types. And then he says that Christ takes on human nature, and that the mediatorial office is not something that's just unique to the divine nature, and it's not something that's just unique to the human nature. But Christ acts according to both of those natures as a mediator. So Christ came to fulfill this office of mediator because of this reconciliation function. So Calvin distinguishes between a cosmic mediation, a mediation of revelation, a mediation of reconciliation, where Christ fills the gap that was between God and man, and he pulls us back to God. There's this idea of the mediation of intercession, where after the ascension, Christ goes into the heavenly places and he intercedes for us on our behalf, and he's mediating for us in that sense. And I started seeing within Calvin and within some of the writings of Stephen Edmondson, and as I was studying other theologians after Calvin, particularly Thomas Goodwin and Herman Bavinck, they talk about this idea of the mediatorship of union. And when I started looking at Calvin's writings, we don't see that kind of language appearing, but we do see Calvin being insistent that the mediator needs to be grounded in the person of Christ rather than just one of the natures. And we see this idea implicitly, and people after Calvin explicitly developed this idea that the hypostatic union itself is an act of mediation. And if Christ was ever to forsake that hypostatic union or discharge the office of mediator, would be in one sense to discharge his flesh, and he would become unincarnate and no longer be a mediator if he didn't have that hypostatic union in that sense.
That's interesting. So is it just that there's different ways to understand mediator? Like there's a broader way of understanding it, of the term, or a narrower understanding of the term, and that might cause some of the confusion between temporary versus eternal mediating?
Yeah. So as I started reading Calvin, how I make sense of that section as the in the Institutes was I came across something in his sermons on Matthew, where he talks about Christ acquitting himself of the duty of the mediator. I have it right here. He says in a sermon on Matthew 27, we need to understand in what ways Christ has achieved the sacrifice for us, and where he acquits himself of the duty of the mediator when he says it is finished on the cross. And I was like, wait a minute. And then I look at the chapter before that, and Calvin says, let us understand the way that Christ is our mediator today. And I thought, huh, so Calvin has in mind a sense where Christ acquits himself of the duty of the mediator when he talks about it is finished. But he has another sense where he's talking about Christ being a mediator perpetually. And how I understood Calvin there, and what sense was Christ acquitting the office of mediator, is he was talking about that Christ inaugurated that reconciliation on the cross and kickstarted that. And that's when our sins were paid for on the cross, but all of creation shall eventually be reconciled one day. And that's how I made sense of this section as in the Institutes, is I saw Calvin saying that the knowledge of God that we have accommodated to us, this is a motif that we see in John Calvin, that the ontological gap between creator and creature is so big that the only way God can communicate knowledge to us is if he stoops to our level and he lisps to us like children, is the way that Calvin describes it. And he sees that the accommodation will cease in the new creation, and that epistemological function, that Christ will no longer need to mediate revelation to us because we'll be with God in his fullness and we'll see him face to face. And there will be no more need for Christ to reconcile us because we'll already be reconciled. It's not like Christ is still reconciling us in the new creation, or Christ is still interceding for us when we're there with him in his presence. So I understand Calvin to say that the priestly functions and the epistemological functions ceasing in the new creation.
So as you're talking about this, I'm wondering, you know, we've had different guests on the show in the past who've talked a little bit about this idea of incarnation anyway, where God had a plan, like prior, logically prior in whatever way, to the fall to say I was going to send my son to become incarnate, whether or not sin actually happened. And I'm wondering if that's the case. It seems like the mediatorial office would have to be eternal and not contingent upon, you know, reconciling us from our sins or whatever, like, or something like that. Do you think that might have any impact on this? If we take incarnation anyway as a legitimate, true category.
Yeah, so there's two things there. In Calvin's commentary on Genesis, where he sees Jacob wrestling with the angel of the Lord in Genesis 18, and I think it's also in Exodus 28:42, we see Calvin referring to Christ as an eternal mediator and as a perpetual mediator. So we could very well say that this is an inconsistency in Calvin's theology with the Institutes, and he later changed his mind about something, or he's referring to a different kind of function, is what I argue. But with the issue of the incarnation anyway, this gets into infralapsarianism and superlapsarianism. And this essentially is a conversation about the decrees and about if Christ has to become incarnate because of the decree, or if Christ becomes incarnate after a creation, and this kind of rescue plan that has to take place afterwards. But there's this idea within the Reformed tradition known as the Covenant of Redemption. And this was a conversation where we see that this starts with Calvin's successor. I'm trying to remember his name. Calvin's successor. Oh.
Theodore Beza,
yes. So we see that he translates this passage in Luke, the word diotheke in Greek. He translates the word covenanted, which is what it literally means, as the Father has assigned or appointed or covenanted a kingdom with me, so I covenant a kingdom with you. And we see this start to take off within the Reformed tradition, where a lot of the post-reformers were saying that this installation to the office of mediator was something that was pre-temporal and something that happened because of the divine decree and because God elected Christ to be the mediator before the foundation of the world. We see that this is something that has to take place. And sometimes in Calvin's logic, we see this idea of the incarnation anyway, where Calvin says man still would have been too lowly to reach God without a mediator, even in his fallen state. But a few chapters after that, he critiques Osiander for speculating that an incarnation would have to take place without a sacrifice. Which just leads to more questions when you're like, okay, is this vain speculation, or do you actually think that the gap needs to be bridged because of the incarnation?
Yeah, man, that's one of the things with Calvin. I love him. He was like, you know, one of my first real like big Reformed systematic theology guys that I read. But there is a sense where he's like really vague about that vain speculation type piece, where it's he almost uses it when he's not sure what to say or how to respond, you know, just put out the charge that this is vain speculation and that'll resolve the worry. But
so I want to be sure I'm tracking along here. So in Calvin's thought, and I could be totally misunderstanding. So in a new creation, Christ no longer is mediator in the priestly and the prophetic functions, but he is in the kingly function. Is that correct?
Yeah. So what I'm seeing in Calvin is that Christ is still a cosmic mediator or some kind of kingly function. Okay. Just as he sustains the first creation, he's sustaining the new creation. And I also see within Calvin the hypostatic union continuing. And some after Calvin in the Reformed tradition have said that Christ still continues to wear the robes of his priesthood. Even though these priestly activities have ceased, because in the New Jerusalem, we see that Jesus Christ himself is the temple. And I think the way that John Owen describes it is he says that tabernacle of Christ's flesh shall never fold away.
So I do want to get to talking about the first and second London confession here in a little bit, because we don't, it seems like, depending on the episode, we don't always have the opportunity to engage someone deeply on this. And I think you've thought about it a lot. And, you know, we're obviously second London guys, so it's a lot of fun to do that. But before we get there, I wanted to make sure we discuss this question. Thinking about the ways that contemporary Christianity narrows the mediatorial office. What ways do they do that? Where do you see that? And why do you see that? You don't have to answer all those in order or anything, but I'm just curious about that question.
Yeah. So I think the way that we see Christ's mediatorial office narrowed within contemporary Christianity is particularly limited to the priestly function or atonement and expiation. So we see Christ dying for us and paying the price for our redemption. But it seems like people forget that Jesus is still in heaven interceding on our behalf. And we have neglected the doctrine of the ascension. And we also don't think about Christ still continuing to guide us by his word and by his spirit through his prophetic office. And we see some in the Reformed tradition afterwards developing this idea, saying that the mediator is the one that has called pastors and feeds his sheep through the proclamation of the word. And Christ is teaching his people through the pastors and through the preachers that he's appointed. William Shedd, in his Dogmatic Theology, essentially talks about preaching being a teaching function of the prophetic office of Christ. And he goes to passages in Ephesians 2, Christ came and preached to you who were far off and to you who were near, and says, look, we see that Christ is preaching to the Gentiles through the ministry of the apostles and through the ministry of teachers that he's installed. And we see Paul in 1 Corinthians rebuking the Corinthians and saying, this is not the things that you have learned from Christ, when he rebukes them for their sexual morality. And 1 Corinthians 6. And we see in Acts chapter 13, I believe, where Paul is casting out a demon out of this one guy. And this guy hears the message that Paul says, and he learned about the teaching of the Lord. And William Shedd goes, huh? So we see that the teaching of the Lord is something that is communicated through the medium of the apostles and the prophets, and that when we go to church and we listen to sermons, we need to be paying attention and hearing from Christ and making sure Christ is speaking to us, and Christ is still continuing that kind of prophetic function. And we don't really think about the continuing humanity of Christ in contemporary Christianity, that Christ is still the God-man. I know that many people they don't give reflection on the idea that Jesus was a human. Like I went up and talked to a friend of mine recently and was just like, isn't it wonderful that Christ is still the God-man, and he's chosen to be that for all eternity? And she wasn't a heretic. She was a Southern Baptist. And she was like, wait, Jesus is still a man? Like, I thought that was, and I was like, yes, Jesus is still a man.
Yeah. I don't think a lot of our folks have thought through these issues. And I've heard people say similar things, you know, just kind of surprised that, you know, and I think you're right that there's been a lack of teaching on the ascension. So that's probably connected to you know, the lack of focus on the ascension. So that's probably why people don't think about Christ still being the God-man. But I do want to maybe transition to what the Baptist confessions teach us about this mediatorial office of Christ, specifically the First London Confession in 1644 and the 1689. So maybe just walk us through those two confessions say, and is there any change or development between the First London Confession and the second?
Yeah, so we see in the 1644 confession, I think it's statement 10, Jesus Christ is made the mediator of the new and everlasting covenant of grace between God and man, ever to be perfectly and fully the prophet, priest, and king of the Church of God forevermore. We don't see that kind of statement in the 1689, that this idea of the prophet, priestly, and kingly functions continue for all eternity. We just read about mainly the priestly office, really emphasized in chapter 8, section 2 through 4. So I found it interesting that the 1644 really emphasizes the continuing prophetic, priestly, and kingly functions rather than just the eternal priesthood. I found that really interesting. It communicates this idea of an eternal munis triplex. We see in 15 and 16 of the 1644, compared to statement 6 of chapter 8 of the 1689, we see that the prophetic office is that they have the statement in the 1644 that Christ is the angel of the covenant, but we don't see this angel of the Lord terminology being communicated to Christ's prophetic office in the 1689 confession. So we see that, and we see again in 17 and 18 of 1644 that Christ's priesthood, I think it's in statement 17 and 18, was not legal or temporary, but it's and it's not for a time for, but it's forever, and it's suitable to Jesus Christ. So, in one sense, Christ's priesthood, or I would say his hypostatic union, is enduring, and it remains forever. And we don't really see that in the 1689, but we do see ways the 1689 clarifies some things that the 1644 had not clarified. Like in statement 19 of the 1644, it says that concerning Christ's kingly office, he applies the fruits of his prophecy and his priesthood to the elect. But we see in chapter 8, section 8, we see these offices distinguished a little more. We see that Christ is it just says that we stand in need of his prophetic office because of these reasons, and the need of his priestly office because of these reasons, and the need of his kingly office. So we don't see this idea of teaching and priesthood being lumped under kinghood like we do in 1644. But we also see in Statement 10, Chapter 8 of the 1689, it adds this statement that looks like a copy-paste It's a copy-paste of the statement about this number and order of offices as necessary for Christ. I think it's Statement 14 in the 1644. It puts that as the last thing on the statement of the mediator, but that's one of the first things on the 1644, but it adds the statement on the priestly office and imperfection of our best services. So we stand in need of Christ's priestly office in respect of alienation from God and imperfection of our best services. We need his priestly office to reconcile us and present us acceptable to God. But we don't see that clause in the 1644. So we see that there's an addition there. But we see this idea of the covenant of redemption in both the 1644 and 1689, where Christ was appointed to this office by God from everlasting. I think it's in statement 11 and statement 10 of the 1644. He's the mediator of the new and everlasting covenant of grace. And God has called him to this office with a special promise. He ordains his son to this office. And then statement 1 of 1689, it pleased God in his eternal purpose to choose and ordain the Lord Jesus according to the covenant made between them both to be the mediator. So we see this idea of the covenant of redemption continuing on in the 1689 confession, but it looks like in some ways the First London Confession emphasizes more about the mediatorial office of Christ that the 1689 really condenses to the priesthood, and it clarifies some things that were unclarified in the 1644.
That's interesting. You know, we talked with James Renahan a few weeks ago, and that episode will drop at some point. So whoever's listening to this, it's available now, so you can go check it out. But at this point, it's not when we're recording. He pretty much argues that there's no, I guess, substantial difference between these two confessions, that they are, I guess, substantially the same, even if the phrasing and is expanded or contracted or changed. But it is interesting, to your point, that the 1644 is very clear that these offices are forevermore. But then when I look in chapter 8, of the 1689, it is difficult to see a clear statement on that. And maybe that's just, it has to do with, you know, they're wanting to, for the most part, follow Westminster and Savoy and, or however you say that last one. All these words, I hear other people say them and I'm like, man, I don't know if I'm saying it right. This other person says it this way, but you know, I'll say it how I want to. So I guess we'll go with that. You know, I got called out by, Andrew Hollingsworth in a very gentle and kind way for calling Pannenberg Pannenberg. So I pronounce things wrong all the time. But maybe, you know, I'm looking here at chapter 8 in 1689. And I know all of our listeners aren't, you know, 1689 junkies or something. That's fine. Go look at it yourself. I think this is interesting for the topic of crisis mediator. I don't see any explicit statement that it's eternal. Even in chapter 8, section 10, it's when it's talking about the order of the offices and how they're necessary, it gives them saying, you know, the prophetical office is necessary because of our ignorance. The priestly office is necessary because of our alienation and imperfection. And the kingly office is necessary, I guess, for our rescue and for our utter inability to return to God. I'm thinking all of these things seem to be completed and fulfilled through the work, earthly work of Christ. So if I were just to look at that, it would seem like, why would Christ still need to be mediator post death, resurrection, ascension? If I just look at that, am I thinking about that right?
Yeah, I think you're thinking about that right. Yeah, I do see that 1689 has dropped some things out. And that goes into a little bit of the development of and Calvin's influence after Calvin with in regards to this doctrine. I think in chapter 4 of my thesis, I look at the mediation theologies of Isaac Ambrose, Thomas Goodwin, Francis Turretin, Herman Bavinck, Abraham Kuyper, and Jonathan Edwards and John Owen. And I see some continuities and discontinuities with some things that Calvinists propose. Like we see with Abraham Kuyper and with Isaac Ambrose in particular, they say that the mediatorial office will cease and that it only had a beginning in time with the incarnation. But they do see that Christ was appointed to this role pretemporally, but we don't see this prophetic and this kingly office happening. Abraham Kuyper says that the beatific vision will be one where we see the divine essence completely. So we won't need to have Christ stand in for us as an intermediary to keep us from seeing that vision. But we see with Francis Turretin, he's like, hold on a second. Christ is going to still be communicating knowledge to us because it says in the New Jerusalem that he will continue to illuminate the saints because he is the light of that temple. We also see him saying that the administration of the kingly function will change, although the it will look different. It's not going to be like this first administration, but the second administration still testifies to the fact that Christ is still a king in some sense, and he still has his flesh for all eternity. And we see that same thing with Jonathan Edwards, as he says, the beatific vision is experienced by those in the intermediate state that go to be with Christ in one way. But after the resurrection, when they have their bodies, they have a more heightened sense of that beatific vision. And John Owen says that Christ's flesh does not ever fold up, but we're only going to be able to see God in and through the face of Jesus Christ. And that Christ's resurrected body is going to enable our resurrected bodies to be able to see God and to see the glory that he had with him before the world began. And Herman Bavinck and Thomas Goodwin talk about this idea of the mediator of union, and that although the mediation of reconciliation shall be finished, there will always be a mediation of union, unless we want to say that Christ will discharge his flesh and become unincarnate. And these are just things that I don't think were developed by everybody within the Reformed tradition. We see some people diverging and making their own mediatorial office theologies. Same thing with William Shedd. We see that he says in his dogmatic theology, the mediatorial office begins at a particular point of time. And since it's temporal, it has to end at a particular point in time.
Yeah. I mean, I got to say, I don't have like a chapter and verse that is like coming to mind here that's telling me exactly what I think on this, but I have an intuition to agree that there has to be a mediation of union. And that's why, like, I would never, like, even if these, some of these other offices did fulfill their functions and ultimately get to their end, achieve their end, I can't imagine or understand how someone could say that Christ stopped being mediator in any sense, because that seems like you are ultimately reducing or destroying the creator creature distinction in some way. It seems like just from that fact that they're creator creature distinction, I should have to say I need a mediator. Even if I don't sin, I need one. I need somebody that can give me, like, connect me, unite me to the fullness that is God. Is that what some guys have touched on with this mediation of union? That's why they're saying that there's this enduring office. Is that the primary piece, or maybe are there others that are actually saying priestly, kingly, prophetic, they also are eternal?
Yeah, so I haven't seen anybody arguing that reconciliation is going to keep happening in the new creation, because that's just really strange and very problematic theologically.
Unless you're a dispensationalist, right? It would at least continue in the, like, millennium.
Right. This idea of animal sacrifices.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry, that was a low blow probably, but, you know, I don't think we have a lot of dispensational listeners. I'll take the shot. They you could shoot me a Twitter message if you got offended.
Yeah. I mean, where we see people really attacking Calvin's theology of mediation begins, I think, with Heinrich Quistorp and Jürgen Moltmann, and a Dutch Reformed theologian named A.A. von Ruler. Moltmann says that Calvin only has a functional... Oh, and Edwin van Driel. Moltmann says that Calvin has a functional mediatorial theology, and that Christ only becomes a mediator in order to rescue us. And he sets out on this divine rescue mission. And once we're reconciled with God, there's not going to be a need for it anymore. And he's going to discharge the office of mediator. And Moltmann interprets that to mean Christ will discharge his flesh, because he looks at this very strange statement in 1 Corinthians 15, Calvin's commentaries, I think 24, 28, where it talks about the flesh as a veil, and it keeps us from seeing the divine essence, and that the veil of Christ's flesh shall be lifted, and he'll transfer everything from his human nature to the divine nature, so that God will reign immediately and we'll be able to see God face to face. Now, I don't know exactly what's going on there, other than a strong view of what people have called the extra Calvinisticum. It's weird, but I don't think, when I look at the rest of Calvin's writings, particularly his commentaries in Genesis and Exodus and that sermon on Matthew 27, I do think he has different mediatorial functions in mind, and he sees the mediatorial office as something that's eternal and something that's perpetual, whatever we're understanding going on there. But we also see A.A. von Ruler. He uses Calvin's logic to say, look, Christ essentially will discharge his flesh and will be one with God. And he uses Marcellus of Ancyra's, like, logic there to make those jumps. And I think that's something that Herman Bovink saw when he was dialoguing with his contemporary Abraham Kuyper. And he's like, no, the mediation of reconciliation will finish, but the mediation of union won't. So I'm not seeing anybody argue about a continuing intercession or priestly function, but I'm seeing people like, what was his name? He just wrote a book on, he teaches at a Grand Canyon. Oh, yeah. The name slips me.
What was the topic?
Doobie?
Yeah, Doobie. Stephen Doobie.
Okay, Stephen.
Yeah, so Stephen Doobie says that this is something that needs to really be a conversation that keeps going, is this idea of the mediation still happening within the new creation. Edwin Van Driel is just essentially critiquing Calvin's theologies, and how he's making sense of those statements is he thinks there's competing eschatologies within Calvin, that Calvin has infralapsarian eschatology at certain points when he talks about mediatorship, and then he has superlapsarian eschatologies happening, and he never fully settles his mind somewhere.
Makes sense. Brandon, was there anything else you wanted to really ask or touch on?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so maybe, Aaron, you just give us your top three resources on this topic for, let's say, a pastor who is wanting to figure out how do I apply this to my local church and in my preaching, and maybe to someone who's a student who just like wants to intellectually enjoy the mediatorial office of Christ.
Well, I would say J.V. Fesco's book, The Trinity and the Covenant of Redemption, is a good source for laymen to understand this idea of the Covenant of Redemption, but a more academic source would be The Covenant of Redemption, Origins, Development, and Reception, to see how in 16th and 17th century English theology, the Covenant of Redemption was used to describe the installation of Christ's office as mediator primordially. Practically, I would say Benjamin Glad's From Adam to Israel to the Church, A Biblical Theology of the People of God. He goes through a few chapters talking about how Jesus is prophet, priest, and king, and how the church become types of under-mediators or prophet, priests, and kings to the world in a particular sense. And Richard Belcher has written a book called Prophet, Priest, and King, The Roles of Christ in the Bible and Our Roles Today. For a biblical theology perspective, Andrew Malone has written a book called God's Mediators, A Biblical Theology of Priesthood. And that's in the New Studies in Biblical Theology series edited by D.A. Carson. And I know that Patrick Schreiner has written a book that I haven't read yet on The Ascension of Christ, Recovering a Neglected Doctrine. But I see Gavin Ortland's reviews talking about, he does a really good job unpacking the prophetic, priestly, and kingly roles of Christ in that book.
Cool, man. That's awesome. So for those who want to follow along with anything that you're doing to see if you're trying to write or publish, or maybe you're just, you know, wanting or, you know, plodding along in a local church or something like that, whatever you're doing, they want to keep up. Do you have a place they can do that? Do you have social media? Do you have a website?
Yeah. So I have a Twitter, and my Twitter handle is WA Pendergrass. So I'm pretty active on there. I share a lot of like quotes and stuff occasionally. I also have an academia.edu page. You can look up Aaron Pendergrass. My thesis is available for access on there, as well as on
awesome.
ProQuest. And I hope to be uploading a few more drafts of some articles that I'm wanting to write in the Calvin Theological Journal soon that will be on there before the fully ones are published.
Fantastic. That's really good. Looking forward to that. I know going through your thesis is probably one of the most well-researched and written MA theses I've ever read. Had I written an MA thesis, it would have been much dumber than what you did. So I don't know if that's you being smart or if that's just James Arcati being really smart, but either way, you guys did a fantastic job with that.
Yeah. I want to give a shout out to Scott Manage too, because he is a prodigious Calvin scholar, and I don't think I would have been able to see some of the issues that were happening in Calvin studies if it wasn't for him and him forcing me to be articulate as well.
Oh, that's good, man. Yeah. The Calvin area is a tough one, because I think everybody who's like semi-reformed at least loves to go to Calvin, but he's got so much stuff out there and they read like little sections of it, and it's hard to know all the ins and outs when you've only read, you know, a couple sections of his stuff. So that's good. Anyway, we want to thank you for coming on the show. I think this was really, really helpful. I think this was really interesting. I think this is a topic that is, I guess, pastorally nourishing as well as intellectually nourishing, and is one that should continue on. So I'm looking forward to the stuff that you continue to do on this. I hope you continue to do it. And I imagine our listeners enjoyed it as well. So we encourage them to check out your stuff. So for all you guys and girls and everybody who've been in between who've been listening to the podcast, we want to remind you that this is the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we thank you for tuning in.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.